around this place.
Well, welcome everyone. It's good to have you here. This is a continuation of the sessions on religion and American public life. Yesterday's session was sort of an overview. We listened to some pieces together and talked with each other and all together about the ways in which churches and other religious groups try to or don't try to influence American public life. The next three sessions are going to be deep dives into three different topics. So yesterday was the overview theme for the week. Today will be racial justice, religion and racial justice. Tomorrow will be religious understandings of abortion. And Friday will be religion and reckoning with sexual abuse within religious communities. So my name is Jason DeRose. I serve the village not only as faculty for this week and next, but I also serve on the board of directors of Holden Village. And when I'm not here, I am the Western Bureau Chief for NPR News and the Senior Editor for Religion, and I also oversee our LGBTQ rights coverage. I used to oversee also our Native and Indigenous rights coverage, but thankfully, because I was doing four jobs, I was able to give one of my four jobs to somebody else. So now I just have three jobs. So I have been at NPR for about 15 years, and I edit stories that you hear on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And I had, for the past, I don't know, 7, 8 years, been coming up here to teach as sort of not really part of my job, but part of my commitment to and interest in Holden Village as a place that gets people thinking deeply about topics like this. So I want to open with a very short reading, or it's an excerpt from a poem, and then we're going to listen to three pieces together, and then we're going to talk amongst ourselves between each of those pieces, and then we're going to close with a reading from the pastor Howard Thurman. It's actually a prayer. So this is the theme for today, and then I'll read this poem. So faith groups have used religion to justify both slavery and abolition, both segregation and integration, and both racial bigotry and racial justice. Now, I think sometimes the loudest voices in America today seem to be a certain brand of white evangelical, whose message, I think, seeks to divide the country on this issue, but historically, churches have been involved on both sides of this issue. They were very involved in the civil rights movement. There were churches very involved in abolition as well. So this session is going to not focus so much on those organizations that seek to divide, but more on those organizations, churches and so forth, and mosques and synagogues that seek to bring people together. So this is just a little poem from William Carlos Williams that helps me think about how I do my job as a reporter and an editor. It's also about why I like to tell stories rather than just do straightforward news reports like a bunch of facts. My heart rouses thinking to bring you news of something that concerns you and concerns many. Look at what passes for the new. You will not find it there, but in despised poems. It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. Hear me out, for I too am concerned, and for everyone who wants to die in peace in his bed or her bed besides. It is hard, hard to get the news from poems. So that's from a very long poem called Asphodel, That Greeny Flower by William Carlos Williams. So the three pieces we're going to listen to today are one about a church that decided to not do something, one about a synagogue, specifically a specific rabbi who decided to do something, and another one about a church that has decided to do something just recently. So this is about doing and not doing. So when you're listening to this first piece, I'd like you to think about something that you personally, or your congregation, if you're part of a congregation, can stop doing in order to bring about some kind of racial justice or racial reconciliation?
Congregants of a church in Oakland, California say they feel like too many people are too quick to call the police when they feel threatened by people of color. So now they're taking what they consider to be a moral stand, to not call the police. Sandra Dirks from member station KQED explains.
Light streams from stained glass windows into the large and airy chapel of the First Congregational Church of Oakland.
On a given Sunday, 50 to 60 people in worship. So we don't nearly fill this space, but the spirit fills the space for sure.
That's Nicola Torbett, a lay leader here. First Congo, as congregants call it, has no preacher. Members take turns at the pulpit. It's also a proudly and intentionally interracial church.
And then we have a Black Lives Matter altar.
The makeshift shrine on the side of the chapel is lined with pictures of Black and brown people killed by police. Some names you've heard of, like Tamir Rice and Oscar Grant. Others you might not have, like Demoria Hogg.
We tried to find candid shots. And then folks, as you can see, have left notes and prayers.
Torbett says as a white woman, she understands the impulse to call police for protection.
Because the world is kind of made and designed for white people. And so when I don't feel comfortable, I think, oh my gosh, I'm not safe.
First Congo member Vanessa Ryle says, in her Black neighborhood, it was police that made people feel unsafe.
Haven't grown up feeling like the police are my heroes or are going to rescue me. I've grown up feeling like, oh, the police don't come when you call them, or they don't really do anything, or somebody calls them on you and your friends when you're not doing anything.
Part of the reason First Congo is doing this is that it has, in the past, called police on people when members have felt threatened. But Ryle says they've re-examined those decisions and want to live out their theology that Black Lives Matter is more than just a slogan.
Can we really feel like we're doing God's will, or that we're following in the footsteps of our movement founder, Jesus, who literally risked himself over and over and over again for people who were the most vulnerable?
The church's decision hasn't made sense to everyone, and conservative media picked up on the story. Here's Fox News' Tucker Carlson.
The church in Oakland that we described in the intro is encouraging its members not to call police even when they feel they need the police. I mean, if that's not a suicidal impulse, what is it?
After that segment aired, the church was bombarded on social media, accusing them of being anti-police. The congregation says that's not true. In fact, Barry Donilon, the head of the Oakland Police Officers Association, says he respects the church's decision. He even wishes there was better education about when and when not to call police.
Most police officers face that on a regular basis, where there's some address they find themselves having to go to on a regular basis for issues that shouldn't be police matters. And yes, it's frustrating.
But Donilon says if something serious happens at the church,
if you ever need us, my members are going to be there to serve you.
First Congo is trying to build an alternative to calling the police, no matter how major the problem. Nicola Torbett says they're creating a team of trained community members who can respond when people feel threatened. She says calling police is really outsourcing violence to the state.
Which is exactly what the religious leaders did when Jesus was arrested. They said, we can't kill him, but you can. Our law forbids it. But you can do it.
Torbett says not calling police is more than a political decision. It's a spiritual practice. For NPR News, I'm Sandhya Dirks in Oakland.
So I'd like you to turn to somebody, to one or two people who are near you, and you can spend a minute or so discussing the piece yourself. But what I'd like you to do is think of things that you could stop doing that might help bring about some kind of racial justice in the world, similar to what this congregation tried to do. And then when you, we're going to come back together after 3 or 4 minutes, and I'm going to have I'm going to ask a couple of people to report back, but you don't get to say what you said. You have to say what somebody else said. This is a journalistic practice. You are listening for what other people are saying. They are listening for what you're saying. So you're not going to tell us what you said, but what somebody else said. So take about 3 or 4 minutes to chat.
Hello.
I'm
Mark.
I'm Sean.
Sean.
Nice to meet you.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, let's start to come back together.
That's a hard question.
So who would like to report back on something that somebody else told you in your small group? Something that somebody stopped doing.
Person of another race tells you about some of the things that have happened to them, you don't just say, but that's never happened, that doesn't happen around here. You say, I hear what you're saying, and let it go at that.
Okay, so acknowledge that someone has told you a story and mm-hmm. believe them, yes. that has been their experience. Yes. Okay. What else did you hear to stop doing? Nobody stopped doing anything?
In terms of stop doing, the conversation that I had with the person I was speaking with and the questions I asked was more about not stop doing, but what are you doing? And one of the questions I asked was, is it just you or do you have people that you do it with? Do you have a specific group that you're able to meet? And she was really open to telling me that yes. And I said, well, what do you do? And she said, well, I'm a part of, I hold signs, or if I could, I would get on social media. I mean, I would find a way to do something. I live in a particularly all-white community on an island, and I think I've shared that before. I live a pretty protected, singular kind of life. So I don't. In my younger days, I worked in Harlem as a street minister. So I've had that experience of what do you do when you see violence or you see prejudice, or I go to different churches and talk about my work, and usually they'd say, well, isn't that dangerous? And my response would be, well, when you break the status quo, that's always dangerous. But her comments were really about doing, not so much stop doing. And I suppose in the doing, you're stopping something right. just by doing it. So anyway, it was a good experience. Yeah. Thank you.
Anybody else can talk about something that they have personally, or that they heard a story of somebody stopping doing?
So one member in our group talked about a situation where there was a African-American man who was disoriented, and he was in front of a parked car and sort of weaving into the street and looking like he might not be terribly safe, but also, I guess, just one of those scary situations. And the person I was listening to said that he made the decision not to call the police because he was pretty sure that that would not go well for that man, and if it was possible to just help this man get on the sidewalk, which is what they did, that was a better outcome.
Does anybody here know if they live in a community that has a non-911 number that you can call if there is something like that? So,
it's, yeah, kind of. I mean, it's a work in progress.
Right.
I mean, Washington State.
It's a work in progress. Washington State there's been a lot of positive things that have happened over the last 2 years, but the implementation has been really erratic, I guess, because of what I will call government think. Mm-hmm. And the question of how much to use imagination to implement things, that's my biased statement about that.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that, you know, there can be this double-edged sword of not calling the police if you see some act of violence being committed against another person. You know, if somebody's chasing somebody down the street with a knife, my impulse would be to call the police, but I also know that that will probably end badly for both one or both of those people. But I'm also you know, concerned personally about like stepping in between somebody who has a knife and someone who doesn't have a knife. So it's a real conundrum, and I don't know that there's a great answer for it. And I think if I had to do that piece over again, I would have pushed the reporter to be more specific about what it means when you... Like, so this was a congregation that had called the police in the past when, like, they felt threatened. Well, I wonder what felt threatened... What constitutes feeling threatened? Like, a black person walked in front of your building? A black person... was trying to break into your building, a black person had a gun to your head. Like, those are three very different levels of what might make you feel threatened. And I think that they were trying to ratchet down the, like, and this, how many of you use or have those Ring cameras on your house? So there's this horrible website called something like Neighbors or Next Door, where people post all sorts of hellaciously racist stuff about how, like, there's a suspicious person in my driveway. Yes. Well, it's actually a black person walking their dog on the sidewalk. That's what that actually is. But we had it for a little while, and I told my husband he had to get rid of it because I could not stand to see all of that from my own neighborhood. It was just too horrific what was going on. Any maybe one more? Okay. Wait, we're recording this, so I just want to make sure that we actually get people's comments recorded.
On a more personal level, something that I've tried to stop doing after, you know, it being pointed out to me is to stop asking my black friends to explain things to me and instead just go figure it out myself when I have the power to do so, which is almost all the time. Because it's a burden on them, and it's like an expectation on our relationship that doesn't help us to actually know each other better as people. To do your homework ahead of time, I found really is helpful. Yeah. So,
I do, however, think it's important to actually do the right kind of homework, because too many people just read whatever they find in Wikipedia, and that's the extent of their research. But people can be great resources, but I think you have to gauge whether they want to be for you.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're willing to a certain extent. Sometimes they're willing to all the time, and sometimes they're not willing to at all, but you have to gauge what that interaction is like. Now I want to play for you a story about stories, a story that raise your hand if you have heard of something called the Freedom Seder. Okay. I figured somebody would in the room. So a few years back was some anniversary of the Freedom Seder. I don't remember which anniversary. And we did this piece. So after we listen, I'm going to ask you to turn to different people than you were just chatting with to talk about times when you got together with people of different experiences, racial experiences, different religious experiences, and just shared your own story of being in the world. This piece is about 5 minutes long.
Last night marked the beginning of Passover, when Jews around the world tell the story of the Exodus. That tale, with its radical message of freedom, has resonated with African Americans since the days of slavery. As Dina Pritchett reports, over 40 years ago, these two communities wove their stories together for a new Passover ritual, the Freedom Seder.
On April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. The U.S. military rolled in to occupy Washington, D.C., and a week later, the sun set on the first night of Passover.
I walked home to get ready for the Seder, and that meant walking past the army with a machine gun pointed at the block I lived on. And my kishkas, my guts, began to say, "This is Pharaoh's army."
Arthur Wasco is now a rabbi, but in 1968, he was working in the peace and civil rights movements, and he decided to come up with a new Haggadah, a guide to the Passover service that spoke to this moment.
I wove the story of the liberation of ancient Hebrews from Pharaoh with the liberation struggles of Black America, of the Vietnamese people, passages from Dr. King, from Gandhi.
In 1969, on the anniversary of King's death, 800 people gathered in the basement of Lincoln Temple, a Black church in Washington, D.C. There were Jews and Christians, rabbis and ministers, Black and white. And they used Wasco's Haggadah to hold a freedom seder. When you listen, it really sounds like a prayer for that moment, both mournful and, at the same time, electric.
It was a bush that burned and burned and did not stop burning. What was God all burned up about? It was the physical, economic, and spiritual suffering, the injustice.
In the church basement that night, the spirit was high.
Topper Carew was one of the readers leading the service. He is now a filmmaker and television producer. But in the late 1960s, Carew was an urban designer working in the civil rights movement.
I will tell you that this was the first Seder that I'd ever been to. I didn't even know what a Seder was. But religion has been a northern star for, you know, much of the movement activity that has gone on in the Black community.
And at Passover, according to Arthur Wasco, that northern star can light up the room.
There is a line that says, in every generation, every human being must look upon himself, herself, as if we go forth from slavery to freedom. And that night, that line became utterly real.
We were slaves unto Pharaoh in Egypt. The Lord our God brought us forth from thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm.
By the late 60s, it was clearer and clearer that American society had opened up to include the Jewish community. It had not opened up, it still hasn't really opened up to include the Black community.
Black and white young rebels are free people, free in a way that Americans have never been before in the history of their country. All power to the people. All power to the people.
Topper Carew raised his fist in that rallying cry more than 45 years ago, but he still remembers the power of that moment.
Both the Jewish community and the Black community have suffered great atrocities, and so the fact that we were coming together was a very important and powerful idea. And the way to best understand that was when people locked arms and sang, "We Shall Overcome."
Moving from slavery to freedom is an eternal journey, a story communities write and rewrite, tell and retell, year after year. Because just as at the Freedom Seder in 1969, there is much to celebrate together, and much work left to do. For NPR News, I'm Dina Prichep.
So I'd like you to turn to a different person than you turned to last time, or two different people than you turned to last time, and share some stories, if you have them, of times when you have come together to tell your story with another person from a different tradition or a different experience, religious or racial, to see where your stories might overlap. So we'll take about 3 or 4 minutes.
Just grown up in policy and state violence. Or opening yourself to this.
Okay, let's start to come back together to share what you've shared in smaller groups. Would somebody like to tell us what they heard in their small group about an experience sharing stories among or between or about racial justice?
I'll share what Jim shared with me, which was probably the biggest example for him to have experience with other people of other faiths, for example, was when he went off to college. And his roommate, you know, first-year roommates are sort of thrust upon each other, right? And he had the experience of being a Lutheran from the Midwest paired with a Jewish kid from Boston and learning about rituals and opinions and stories and all that kind of stuff. So that's a very intimate kind right. of experience, right?
And not one that you necessarily even chose. It just chose you.
Right, right, yeah. So that's what I heard from Jim.
Great. Other stories, maybe two others that you could share?
Well, I don't really know if this is a justice issue.
I'm sorry. We're recording, so we want to make sure.
Oh, okay. So I'm not sure if this is sort of the racial justice piece that you were looking for, but I got involved with an Afghani family that had to escape about 3 years ago and come to the United States, and mostly the challenges of, you know, there was a 14-year-old girl, a 16-year-old girl, there are actually five children, but those two in particular, having to go right into our school system, right into middle school, right into high school, they had never been educated at all outside of their home. And so trying to walk this path with them about how will they ever catch up, you know, we've got this system that we expect you to know certain things at certain levels, and anyway, so there's a huge gap and disparity on how they will become immersed and therefore succeed here and be able to help their family just financially and everything. So
right. And there you've got, I guess, you know, they're Central Asian, so they're not, you know, white Americans, and they're also presumably Muslim. Mm-hmm. So they're a religious minority and a racial minority. Mm-hmm. And frankly, a dramatic cultural minority. I mean, yeah. If you were raised in Afghanistan, there are parts you could be a person of color from South Asia and be much more easily integrated into America than if you were a woman from Afghanistan trying to integrate into the U.S. Yeah. Maybe one more story? I had to take a class in how to lead meetings on Zoom, and they said you're supposed to count to seven, which will let people decide that they want to talk.
Seven.
Had you heard that too?
No, I'm filing it.
Anybody else?
I'll just say it was funny to hear Art's voice because I've actually met him in the shower. We were both naked.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. Oh. You knew him? You felt
I totally different off the subject, but hearing Art's voice, I've actually met him in the shower at a conference.
Oh, okay.
We both were naked.
Oh.
And we had a nice conversation.
This one does. Yeah, I especially like that story because it uses all of the devices of radio, because you know what you're hearing is us moving in and out of the past, and you have 45-year-old versions of people's voices, and then you've got 45 years later versions of those people's voices. And the last line, or the second to last line in there, is something that I have used time and again, and some friends, my husband is Jewish, and so some friends, we get together for Seder every year. And I love that line from this so much that I've incorporated into our Haggadah, which has to do with you tell and retell the story of becoming free until it becomes true, which is a sentiment that I like. Mm-hmm. So I have one more piece that I want to play for you about what a specific congregation in the Northeast has decided to do in order to have some measure of racial justice and racial reconciliation. And I thought it would be good to play this at a place like Holden because I presume many people, if not almost all people here, are in some way related to or come here through a congregation of some sort and have some kind of faith community that they participate in. And so this was an example that I ran across and thought, what a fantastic idea. And the minute I floated it at my own congregation, people got very nervous. So I'm going to ask you to talk about something that you think you could affirmatively do in order to bring about some kind of racial justice in your own community. I muted it.
Lives Matters. As the national reckoning over racism grew over the past few years, many churches put up Black Lives Matter signs. A few are now going a step further and are trying to acknowledge financially the origins of some of the songs they sing during services. From member station WGBH in Boston, Greg LaMolt has the story.
A 100 or so masked parishioners in the pews of the United Parish in Brookline joined together in singing, "Lord, I Want to Be a Christian in My Heart." This song, like many that churches sing all over the country, comes from a musical tradition of spirituals originally composed by African people enslaved in America. Susan DeSelms is the minister of music at the United Parish, which is predominantly white.
There's a lot of, you know, there was growing discomfort around how to use Negro spirituals appropriately and respectfully.
Some parishioners began asking whether it was okay for a mostly white church to sing them at all. That debate within the church heated up, she says, after the murder of George Floyd.
And it brought up a lot of emotions from a lot of people. And I started thinking about, well, what can make this right? What can make this not feel terrible? And how do we get through this? I mean, we have a sign on our church that says Black Lives Matter, but what else? You know, what else do you want to do about that?
DeSelms addressed the issue head on in a recent homily at the church.
We're talking about Negro spirituals today.
She starts off by addressing that word, which she tells the church is the preferred term for this music in Black communities.
Words matter. And while using the word Negro, even in this context, gives me discomfort, I can acknowledge that the discomfort is mine. And it comes from the shame I feel as a white person of privilege.
DeSelms recounts the history of the music, beginning in 1619, when the first Africans were brought to America as slaves. And she says many people don't even realize which are Negro spirituals.
So let's test our knowledge. This little light of mine, swing low, I've got peace like a river.
When a church buys sheet music, the composers or their estates usually get some of that money as royalties. But the enslaved people who composed this music were never paid for their art. So DeSelms had an idea, which he announced at the service.
Today, we as a church will begin the practice of collecting royalties for the spirituals we sing and worship. Whenever we sing Negro spirituals, we will collect an offering that will support the development of Black musicians.
Those royalties, as they're calling them, will be donated to a nonprofit youth music program called Hamilton Garrett Music and Arts in the majority Black Boston community of Roxbury. Seven girls in Hamilton Garrett's youth choir, ranging in age from 10 to 17, rehearse as the program's executive director, Jeremy Groover Flores, directs. The organization is devoted to carrying on the tradition of the Negro spiritual by teaching these songs to the next generation. Groover Flores says she didn't always think that white churches should sing this music.
I think at one point in time in my life, I used to feel frustrated about it, to be fully transparent. I think that was just because of the fact that I wasn't quite sure that the individuals who were singing it truly understood the history behind it.
But she says she now thinks they need more people to learn from this music and embrace it.
So let's start having these conversations, building these partnerships where we can start to give the acknowledgement back to those who have created such a beautiful art form that we celebrate today. My God is
in a weary land. At the same time, the Massachusetts church was working through these issues. An almost identical idea took shape at Montview Church in Denver, where the music includes performances like this one. The church's music minister, Adam Waite, says the idea started with a suggestion from his coach in an anti-racism training program.
You know, she went right there. She's like, how about reparations? Have you thought about that?
They talked it through and landed on the idea of what they're calling a reparations royalty program, which could potentially include a donation anytime they perform a song by any black composer. Waite says they could either ignore how black artists have been treated in this country throughout history or acknowledge it.
As a white, predominantly privileged congregation, that's a choice we need to make, is to actively engage with our history, to be honest about our history. And hopefully that will make us a better community.
To help shape the idea into something that other churches could try, they reached out to the Center for Congregational Song. The center's director, Brian Hain, created an online questionnaire designed to guide houses of worship towards something similar. Hain says this shouldn't be about helping white churches feel better about themselves.
We have to decenter our own feelings. This is not about alleviating our guilt. Rather, it's about inspiring our communities to build deeper relationships with people who look, think, act differently than we do, and have different historical realities than we do.
Around the country, some white churches have been grappling for years with the appropriate way to sing these songs.
There are other congregations who have brought in consultants to help teach performance practice.
Emmett Price is a minister and the Dean of Africana Studies at the Berklee College of Music.
There are other congregations who have brought in consultants to contextualize the music so that the folks who are singing the music actually understand what they're singing. Since it comes from a different cultural background and a different cultural expression.
But he says he's never seen churches make financial contributions like this before.
This whole thing about the royalties for spirituals actually puts your wallet where your mouth is.
Price says this is a great model for racial reconciliation, but he does think it has its limits.
I don't think every white church in America has the capacity, has the vision, has the people who would catch the vision.
For the Hamilton Garrett Youth Choir in Boston, that vision is translating into tangible support. The organization's director, Jeremy Groover Flores, says the royalties are helping carry on the legacy of this music.
They are, in some ways, repaying the individuals who create this music because you're supporting their descendants. You're supporting the next generation of their lineage to continue the work and the mission of preserving this art form, of preserving this history.
Groover Flores says the white congregation is honoring this music when they sing it, and now trying to do justice for those who created it. For NPR News, I'm Craig LaMolt in Boston.
I love that story. That's like my favorite story in the past few months. I rarely get to do like news you can use, but I insisted that that piece not air on Sunday morning because it aired on Saturday morning because I just knew that I needed congregations or pastors to be able to hear it, and they would all be in church on Sunday morning. So I said, it can't air Sunday morning. There's often this weird impetus to want to put the religion story on Sunday mornings, and I'm like, if you put it on a Sunday morning, some of the people who need to hear it aren't going to hear it. So. Well, I'd like you to, for one final time this afternoon, get together with somebody that you've not yet gotten together with and brainstorm some things, or you know, maybe tell a story of something you have affirmatively done to lead to racial reconciliation, or brainstorm some ideas of things that you could do personally, your family, or your congregation might be able to do. It'll take about 3 or 4 minutes to talk. Okay, we'll come back together and share some of what we heard from each other. Okay, would anybody like to start by sharing what you heard from somebody in your small group about something affirmative that they or their congregation or their family or their community has done in the interest of furthering racial justice and racial reconciliation? You would think I would remember to hold a microphone when people talk, given my job. four, five, six. I heard a lot of talking. People just don't want to share.
Well, we weren't exactly on topic. Oh.
Well, what did you talk about?
So we had one person in our group talking about being part of a music program where Black, you know, Negro spiritual literature repertoire is being performed both by voice students and by a choir, and the debate that has gone on in that community around the appropriateness of very white kids or young people singing, performing this repertoire, and sometimes in situations where there's actually money is being charged for it.
Like so at a concert.
There's been a debate in the community, and to make things kind of interesting, the director of that choir, and I guess probably the vocal program, I'm not sure, is a Black man, and who feels that the music should not be restricted just to the Black community, but that it should be, that it can and should be out there as an, so that the non-Black community can learn about this music and understand where it comes from and understand its particular unique power and message. So that was interesting.
I know that school well. That's been a conversation going on since I was a student there 30 years ago. So, any other stories that people heard? Yes.
In my own experience, I never even thought about what you brought to us today. It has never even occurred, and I've sung in some pretty high-level choirs and been in music almost my whole life, not professionally, but as a lover of music. I've never heard this before. You know, how did I miss this? Because I consider myself a fairly enlightened person. And as I mentioned, I had spent, as a conscious objector, 2 years in Harlem. And I never had even considered this. So this was a tremendous learning for me. Our choir, by the way, I love the St. Olaf choir. I think it's one of the best choirs in the country.
Well, because it is.
It is, yeah. It is. And I even have a couple of their recordings. Our choir director, Carl Olson, has been here as a music director over a period of several years, and he's a professional person. So I'm going to bring it back to him. He's very open, and I'm going to say, Carl, this is what I learned at Holden. We need to consider this as an almost total, we are total white, Lutheran, middle-class church. And we have some military people. It's the broad spectrum. We have 1,500 members in this small island community, so it's a powerful group. So I'm going to bring it to Carl and say, "This, we need to change our consciousness about this." And probably half the people will get up and walk away, but you know, that's okay. Right. But thanks for bringing that.
Well, there are resources from the Center for Congregational Song that you could access, and so I hope that you know, I think there are several clergy people in this room, so you know, take that back to your congregation. I don't know how it will go over in every congregation, but I just, as soon as I heard about this, I thought, this is a brilliant idea. And I think that the one part that's really important, there's the guy who teaches at Berklee School of Music, you know, don't do this just to assuage your own guilt. I mean, if your guilt ends up getting assuaged, fine, but like, that can't be the reason you're doing it. You're actually trying to make things right for communities that have been harmed by systemic racism, and this is a concrete thing that congregations can do because they are doing something already by singing those hymns, and maybe not just sing them, but learn about them and learn about what gave rise to them. So I want to close with, this is the end of a sermon by the civil rights leader, Pastor Howard Thurman. The sermon is called, What Shall I Do With My Life? And it's collected in a series of his sermons called Strange Freedom. But this is a sermon that I always think it's funny to know this. He gave this sermon many, many times over the course of his life. It worked well in many different settings. But this is the end, and this is how he ends this sermon about what we can do. We don't have to feel hopeless in working for racial justice and racial reconciliation. So this is the prayer. Give me courage to live, really live, not merely exist. Live dangerously scorning risk. Live honestly daring the truth, particularly the truth of myself. Live resiliently, ever changing, ever growing, ever adapting, enduring the pain of change as though 'twere the travail of birth. Give me the courage to live, give me the strength to be free and endure the burden of freedom and the loneliness of those without chains. Let me not be trapped by success, nor by failure, nor pleasure, nor grief, nor malice, nor praise, nor remorse. Give me the courage to go on, facing all that waits on the trail, going eagerly, joyously on, and paying my way as I go without anger or fear or regret, taking what life gives, spending myself to the full, head high, spirit winged, like God, on, till the shadows draw close. Then, even when darkness shuts down, and I go alone, as I come, naked and blind as I came, even then, gracious God, hear my prayer. Give me the courage to live. Amen. Amen. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.